Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 18th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Conditions are worsening for children and aid workers in rebel-controlled DRC Congo cities of Goma and Bukavu.
We've got huge numbers of children who were already displaced because of fighting over the last few years. They've been living in camps, particularly around the city of Goma. But the recent fighting has led to a massive new wave of displacement. Around 700,000 people have been displaced just in the last 3 months.
Top UN officials are seeking $6 billion for Sudan this year from donors to help ease suffering in what they call an unprecedented crisis. The Kenyan National Human Rights Commission is yet to confirm who is behind recent abductions. Farm workers who are not legal U.S. residents are staying away from work. A week-long Malian festival of music, visual art, theater, and dance is threatened by jihadist activity.
Mali and its neighbors have been battling jihadist groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda for more than a decade. Another of Mali's festivals, the Festival in the Desert outside Timbuktu, once attracted thousands of visitors.
And Google reverses its policy against developing artificial intelligence weapons. Those stories are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Conditions are worsening for children and aid workers in the rebel-controlled DR Congo cities of Goma and Bukavu, according to UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. John James, UNICEF communications specialist, told me sexual violence against children has surged with thousands displaced and humanitarian aid warehouses looted.
It's a rapidly evolving situation here. And for children especially, it's something that is a big concern for us. For children, we've got huge numbers of children who were already displaced because of fighting over the last few years. They've been living in camps, particularly around the city of Goma. But the recent fighting has led to a massive new wave of displacement. Around 700,000 people have been displaced just in the last 3 months, and roughly half of those are children. So they're having to leave even their temporary homes, moving to new parts of the city, moving else from the country. We've also seen reports of grave violations against children. One of our partners reported a fivefold increase in cases of rape and sexual violence just at the end of January. We've also seen a lot of children separated from their families as well. We've come across about 1,100 children who've been separated, and so we'll need to work with the authorities, with partners, to bring them back to their families. So really a very worrying situation for children. Before we even talk about schools, about 1,200 have just closed over the last few weeks. We've now got an additional 300,000 children out of school, so extremely difficult for children in this part of the world.
How are you dealing with these extreme conditions and this forever changing, evolving situations for you and your staff?
It's difficult. I mean, we're having to adapt to the evolving situation. Now, currently in Goma, we're working to deliver, you know, as the conflict has moved to other parts of the area. But, you know, just over the weekend, we have a sub-office in Bukavu. That's the second city in this part of the world. And that's changed hands politically. But our staff there are safe. And we're keen to still be here, staying on the ground and delivering. We're working with many committed local partners as well. At the same time, it's very difficult conditions. And many partners here in Goma saw their warehouses looted. So that's a lot of humanitarian support taken away, which aren't available for vulnerable families. And our own warehouse itself was looted just over the weekend in Bukavu, along with many other organizations. So that means we don't have those supplies, and it can make it difficult delivering for children and for families in this part of the world.
And since it appears there's no quote-unquote rules of engagement with all these armed groups and parties, what is the security like, especially not just for you, for the children as well?
It varies from place to place. It depends if there's an ongoing conflict in certain communities or if things have moved on. Currently, Goma is reasonably calm. I traveled around the city yesterday. So people are starting to come out of their homes. Businesses are opening. The banks are closed, which makes things very difficult. But, you know, as humanitarian actors, we want to be able to do our work. And there are mechanisms in place to work with the authorities wherever we are. And so there's some coordination there at that level, just so we can deliver. But in other places, you know, it's been very difficult. And we've seen humanitarian workers killed over the last few weeks in different parts of this region. So it can be very difficult. And, you know, delivering as well is very challenging. The main airport in Goma, which is used for bringing in supplies, is out of action now. And that's a vital piece of infrastructure for delivering for people in this region.
Since it's reported that the rebels M23 and its allies are in charge of Goma and they're also in charge of Bukavu, are you in touch with the government at all, or you are just working with the rebels and they're providing security for you? How is that working?
For us, our humanitarian work is largely coordinated through a UN agency called OCHA, who coordinate humanitarian affairs. And so everything can be channeled through them to deal with the de facto authorities and those here, just to make sure that we can do our work.
That's John James, UNICEF communication specialist, speaking with me from Goma. Top UN officials sought $6 billion for Sudan this year from donors to help ease suffering in what they call an unprecedented crisis characterized by mass displacement and the world's worst hunger catastrophe ever. A UN statement said that farming conditions have been reported in at least 5 locations in Sudan, including displacement camps in Darfur, adding that this was set to worsen with continued fighting and the collapse of basic services. One of the famine-stricken camps was attacked by the RSF last week as the paramilitary group tries to tighten its grip on its Darfur stronghold. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Tom Fletcher.
Today to launch 2 plans. Together, they request $6 billion to support close to 21 million people in Sudan and up to 5 million others, primarily refugees, in neighboring countries. And as I said at the start, we recognize that this is a staggering amount of money, the largest UN-coordinated appeal in Sudan's history. It would be a staggering amount to try to raise in normal times, let alone in the midst of the financial squeeze that we're experiencing. A lot of us are probably sat here thinking, is the United Nations humanitarian system really launching its biggest ever Sudan humanitarian appeal at a moment when the conversation is understandably about aid cuts and aid freezes and the toughest potential environment for humanitarian work in our living, working memory? But a tough funding crisis doesn't mean that crises in places like Sudan disappear. And I refuse to believe that behind these challenges, we collectively have lost our ability to reach out and support those in direst need. And so, yes, maybe it does feel strange to be launching an appeal on this scale at this moment. But would it not feel even stranger for us not to be launching an appeal at this scale when the needs are so great? Because this is a humanitarian crisis that is truly unprecedented in its scale and gravity. And it demands a response unprecedented in scale and intent. It's a crisis that is increasingly crossing Sudan's borders, threatening to destabilize neighbors in ways that risk being felt for generations to come.
That's UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Tom Fletcher. Since June 2024, when a series of mass protests took place in Kenya, 82 cases of alleged forced disappearances have been recorded, according to the Kenyan National Human Rights Commission. It's yet to be confirmed who is behind the abductions. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo, who spoke to 2 brothers who said they were abducted for 32 days, has this report.
It's here, in the Kitengela town neighborhood, about an hour away from central Nairobi, that Aslam Longton and his brother Jamil say they were abducted. Earlier that day in August, Aslam says he felt uneasy and noticed unfamiliar people were watching him. The brothers were riding together by car when things unraveled.
That first corner, there was a Toyota Vixt parked there. Opened the old doors, so I cannot pass there. So I reversed the car. I come this place. When I entered this place, there was a Subaru come and blocked me here. And Toyota Axio blocked me at behind of there.
The brothers alleged they were approached by heavily armed men they described as appearing to be police officers and asked to switch off their car. Once again, here is Aslam.
They opened the car, removed me at the steering, took me very fast to the Subaru.
Jamil Langton says he was not meant to be taken away that day, but when he pressed the officers, even suggesting to call the neighborhood's police station, they refused to introduce themselves.
I kept on asking them, who are you? Where are you taking my brother? I told them, I'll call the OCS Kitengela police station to ask him if he's aware of whatever you're doing. When I attempted to call the OCS, my phone was confiscated by them. I was slapped, my phone switched off, and I was also bungled into the Subaru.
The brothers say they were handcuffed, blindfolded, taken to a location, and held there for 32 days. Amnesty International and Kenya National Commission on Human Rights confirm the accounts by the two men and say it's similar to the treatment of other abductees. KNHCR's Ernest Cornell.
Number one, they are telling us that they were denied food. They were kept in handcuffs for days. They were stripped naked and they were made to lie on concrete floors.
Aslam says he was taken due to his participation in the nationwide youth-led Gen Z protest last year against a proposed bill that would have increased taxes. The protest expanded into a call for an end to corruption and for the president to resign. The bill was eventually withdrawn. Aslam's brother didn't take part in the protest, but they say they were both repeatedly questioned about its funding source during their captivity. Rights groups accused the Kenyan police of using excessive force against protesters and in some cases abducting government critics. Police denied the allegations. The police also said that they had credible evidence criminal gangs had infiltrated the protests and planned to take advantage. In December, following more protests in Nairobi to demand the police produce the missing people, President William Ruto condemned the spike in disappearances.
Any criminality must be investigated, whether undertaken by citizens or criminals or undertaken by the police. It must be investigated.
Our requests for comments from the National Police Service were not answered. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 18th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. A week-long Malian festival of music, visual art, theater, and dance is threatened by jihadist activity. Lucy Field of Reuters has more.
Tens of thousands of people flocked to the Malian town of Ségou for a week-long celebration of music, art, theater, and dance. It's an annual event, but this time around, the Festival Sur le Niger has kicked off against the backdrop of uncertainty and a shifting political landscape. Just days before the festival began, Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger formally left ECOWAS. The West African political and economic bloc had been urging the three neighbouring countries to return to democratic rule, and uncertainty remains over when Mali's military junta will make good on its vow to organise elections. The three countries have announced a new confederation known as the Alliance of Sahel States, or AES, and authorities dubbed this year's festival as the Week of AES Fraternity. Portraits of the three junta leaders were splashed on posters throughout the grounds. Mamou Dafé is Mali's culture minister.
You are aware of the current context of our country. For over a decade, we have been facing a crisis. Our department, in its overall vision, works across all regions to promote diversity, social cohesion, and coexistence.
Mali is a renowned hub of culture in the region. However, that vibrant scene is under threat. Mali and its neighbours have been battling jihadist groups linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda for more than a decade. That's in addition to a longer history of Tuareg-led rebellion in Mali's north. Another of Mali's festivals, the Festival in the Desert outside Timbuktu, once attracted thousands of visitors. But it has not been held since 2012 when jihadists entered the ancient city. At the festival, artist Mamadou Tienta has created an installation featuring repaired calabash containers.
I observed that joining two cracked parts of a calabash or stitching together several fragments symbolizes gathering and unity, which directly relates to reconciliation. Today in Africa, we dream of understanding, peace and reconciliation.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters reporting. And in Central California, it is harvesting season for strawberries and citrus fruits. But some farm workers who are not legal U.S. residents are staying away from work following migrant roundups that are part of President Donald Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration. Gina Dulu has our story.
Alejandra is an undocumented farm worker in California who does not want to show her face or share her last name for fear of deportation. She says she was on her way to work earlier this year when agents from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, started rounding up undocumented migrants around the city of Bakersfield.
That was on Tuesday when they started the raids. And on Wednesday, we didn't go out because we were scared. We heard and saw the whole day that ICE was being very active. They were in the key places where all the farm workers have to go through, where the citrus groves are. So the next day, I didn't go to work because I was scared.
United Farm Workers Union President Teresa Romero says two of their members were detained.
The farm workers that were deported have been here working for 15, 20 years. They don't even have a parking ticket. They were stopped in the street. It's not that they had a warrant against a specific person. They were just stopped by unmarked vehicles going home from work.
While the Trump administration says these first migrant roundups will focus on suspected criminals, U.S. Border Czar Tom Homan says it is only the beginning.
As the aperture opens up beyond criminals, you're going to see more arrests. I made it clear. If you're in the country legally, you're not off the table.
In Bakersfield, resident James Miller says deportations may create a shortage of field workers here, but immigration agents must enforce the law.
I think it's misleading when it was interpreted that they were going to raid the schools. So they have a job to do, and they should do it. Is it going to impact us? Probably so.
Another resident, J.P. Avalos, says the economic impact here may be significant.
We'll see 2-3 months' time where when the Latinos and you guys, when this happens and they kick them out, let's see where your food costs are and what you guys got to do to get that, you know?
Neighboring Ventura County has also seen immigration enforcement raids under the new administration. More than 80% of field harvesters here are undocumented migrants, according to estimates by the nonprofit Farm Bureau of Ventura County. Maureen McGuire is the Bureau's CEO.
If we have mass deportation and we lose the labor force that harvests, there will be a lower supply of food for, you know, those individual commodities that are affected. And then the grocery stores will be in competition for who gets that limited resource. That will drive the prices up.
Alejandra says she went back to work picking carrots a few days after the roundups, but is keeping herself and her U.S.-born son out of public places in hopes of avoiding immigration agents. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, Bakersfield, California.
Thank you, Jenya. And Sudan's Army Chief Abdel Fattah Burhan has rejected in the de facto capital, Port Sudan, the possible formation of a government. It was planned to be announced on Tuesday by paramilitary rapid support forces and allied politicians. The RSF, along with allied politicians, are expected to sign a charter in Nairobi on Tuesday, establishing a government in the territories that the RSF controls. Such a government is not expected to gain wide recognition, but the move furthers the splintering of the country over an almost two-year war. Burhan also criticized a recent meeting by the African Union and IGAD on development of Eastern African Organization. IGAD hosted former Prime Minister Abdel Hamdok and said the Sudanese people reject such attempts to impose a solution to the ongoing war from outside the country. And technology company Google recently broke its long-standing policy against developing AI weapons. VOA's Matt Dibble has more.
For years, Google, the technology giant founded with the principle of don't do evil, included on its website a commitment against developing weapons and technologies that cause harm or can be used for surveillance. But last week, that language was removed from the company's AI principles page. Google, whose parent company is Alphabet, did not immediately reply to a request for comment for this story. A blog post by Google leadership explaining the new policy said, "There's a global competition taking place for AI leadership within an increasingly complex geopolitical landscape. We believe democracies should lead in AI development." Some observers see the move as evidence that the company is now openly promoting its artificial intelligence technologies for use in warfare. AI is increasingly used on battlefields, from Ukraine to Gaza, and Silicon Valley tech companies, once averse to seeing their tools used for destructive purposes, have been backing away from longstanding policies against military use. OpenAI, Meta, and Anthropic all have AI projects with the U.S. military or defense contractors. AI is primarily used in determining targets for drone strikes, in some cases in a fully autonomous weapon. Leading AI researcher Stuart Russell, an autonomous weapons opponent, attended the AI Action Summit in Paris.
Increasingly, the progress of the war in Ukraine is dictated by the use of either remotely operated drones or fully autonomous drones. That's been a radical change. So I think many military strategists think that without this kind of capability, you just can't fight a modern war.
Google's connection to the military is not new. In 2017, despite the company's stated principles, it helped build a targeting system called Project Maven for the U.S. Department of Defense. A year later, after thousands of employees protested, Google ended the contract. More recently, critics say Project Nimbus, a $1.2 billion contract between Google, Amazon, and the Israeli government for cloud computing services, was used for surveillance and targeting in the Gaza war. For Russell and other observers, Google's shift in policy was concerning.
You have to assume that it's not a coincidence that this change in policy comes with a new administration that has removed all the regulations on AI that were placed by the Biden administration and is now placing a huge emphasis on the use of AI for military prowess.
As AI advances rapidly, governments and businesses alike are increasingly worried about falling behind. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Oakland, California.
And in more news, civilians who fled from Bukavu in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo following clashes between M23 rebels and the country's armed forces arrived in buses on Monday. They carried their belongings as they walked towards the Rusizi border crossing to return home. In recent weeks, the Eastern DRC has witnessed escalating violence, particularly in the town of Bukavu, which is the commercial capital city of South Kivu province. The group's recent gains in the North and South Kivu provinces means it has captured more territory than all other rebellions since the end of two major wars that ran from 1996 to 2003. These advances have also handed them control of some of the region's valuable mineral deposits. On Sunday, there were little sign of the clashes and bloodshed that preceded the capture of Goma, where about 3,000 people were killed, according to the United Nations. And that's all for this Tuesday, February 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for tuning in. And for more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the entire Daybreak crew, I'm Chinedofo in Washington, wishing you a great day.
Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.